This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. I am coming to you from Boston, where the suddenly struggling Celtics are headed home for a long homestand over Christmas. Beck is in New York, where two of the hottest teams in the NBA right now reside. Beck,
let's not talk about the crazy Nets.
Well, if you want to get technical, like that's that's true. I mean, the Nets are playing good basketball. We'll get into them. I was in New York on Sunday watching the Knicks beat the Kings, and yeah, the Knicks have had some pretty good fortune when it comes to other teams and their star players. The Kings are without De'Aaron Fox. They played, I think, the Sixers without Embiid. They've been playing all these teams that have not had their top players. Hawks without DeJounte Murray, but they've been winning, so you got to give it to Tibbs. You got to give it to the Knicks. They're starting to defend again. And climbing the standings up in, I think, what, that 5-6 spot right now. So good for the Knicks. I know you're a Knicks skeptic, but starting to put some wins together, Howard.
This is going to be the story of their season. They're going to win three or four in a row. They're going to lose three or four in a row. And every time they have a losing skid, it's going to be fire everybody. Every day that the Knicks lose, especially if they've lost a few in a row, I wake up and I get on Twitter and the trending topics are Leon Rose, Tibbs, and it's not like fire anybody. It's just the names are there. And then, but I know what's going to happen if I click the trending topics. It is just a total meltdown. And then they win four in a row and everything's fine. They're a game over 500. And this is a season where being a game over 500 in either conference means you're always within striking distance of the top. But let's not delude ourselves. And we'll get to the Nets. I'm not deluding myself about that New York team either, but the Knicks are going to hover around 500 all year. That's what they are. They put together a 500 team at best that's going to flirt with a game or two over or a game or two under all season. So no four-game winning streak should be considered anything significant, I would say.
I forgot how much I loved the Tom Thibodeau press conference. Like, he just says words. Like, our friend Michael Pina was there, our former colleague, now over with the Ringer, and he was obviously working on something on Domas Sabonis with the Kings, and he was asking Tibbs about Sabonis, and Tibbs just starts rattling off, like, you know, one-word sentences, like strong, physical, could shoot, score it.
Just kind of grunts his way through a post-game press conference.
It was even pregame. It was wild. We're going to get into the Nets on this episode. We're going to talk about Russell Westbrook's successful transition into the sixth man role and what that means for him and his future. And the Wizards, is it time for the Wizards to start thinking about options when it comes to Bradley Beal? One personal note from this week, of course, the sports world took notice with the passing of Grant Wall, the longtime Sports Illustrated writer over in Qatar. I don't even know what to say about it, because it's been such a surreal last few days. You know, I got a phone call from one of my longtime colleagues who passed along the news, and I just remember being on the phone with this person being like, you got to be bleeping kidding me. Like, you couldn't believe something like that could actually happen. I got to Sports Illustrated back in 2002. Grant had been there for about 6-7 years at that point, already, even at a young age, well-established as one of the top college basketball writers in the country, someone who at that time was writing these incredible soccer features on the side, back when soccer was nothing in the American market. And if my takeaway from my early days as a fact checker and my experience with Grant is anything, it's just how incredibly gracious he was with his time, with his resources, whether it was helping you piece together a story or eagerly or willingly handing over a contact. I mean, like Grant, I mean, you know, back in those days, the way the Sports Illustrated kind of masthead worked was you got into the door as a fact checker and you eventually worked your way up into a writing position. Chris Ballard did it. I did it. Grant did it. There's a whole lot of guys that did it back in the early aughts. And, you know, you don't expect someone like Grant even then to be as just incredible with his time as he was, but he was like that. And if you open up Twitter in the last couple of days and read all the tributes to Grant Wall, you see he was like that with everybody in the business. And there isn't a better legacy that you can leave than that. I mean, he did leave another legacy. I mean, the guy, how many of us can say at the end of our careers that we played an instrumental role in the growth of a sport? You and I, Howard, love the NBA. We talk about the NBA, write about the NBA. I don't think we play a substantive role in growing the NBA. Grant Wall did. Grant Wall was, as I mentioned, introducing the country, I should say, because it was a global sport, as Grant was well aware, but introducing the U.S. to soccer in ways that it had never been introduced before, writing these incredible features on soccer stars that played a prominent role in soccer's growth in this country. And you could see in the days after all the people that acknowledged that work that Grant put in. I hadn't seen Grant in a few years. Obviously, the pandemic happened that kept us all out of the office. He left Sports Illustrated in 2020. But, you know, I remember during the pandemic, and this was after he had left SI, I had reached out to him about speaking to his wife, Dr. Celine Gounder, who is one of the preeminent doctors when it comes to the COVID-19 virus in the country. And just like Grant, quickly got back to you, said she'd be happy to do it, connected me, did things you didn't really need to do if you were him. So he will be incredibly missed. You feel for his family. The only thing Grant loved more than soccer was his wife. And he was incredibly vocal and public about that. So proud of her was he for the work that she put in during the COVID-19 pandemic, the throes of it. And he was vocal about that every day of the week. So we lost a good person. We lost a good writer. We just, the world is a worse place without Grant Wall in it. That's kind of where I stand. I know you didn't get a chance, I think, to work with him, did you, Howard? But
No.
I'm sure you've seen everything that's come out over the last couple of days.
No, the absolute outpouring of, you know, sadness, sympathy, respect, appreciation for him says it all. And at times like this, that as screwed up as Twitter is, I'm glad we have it so that we can all see this. For those of us who didn't know Grant, and for everybody who did know him, to be able to celebrate him in kind of that public space where obviously a lot of sports fans and a lot of journalists are all gathering on Twitter. It was a great it was great to see the celebration of his work and his life gone way too soon. I'm sorry I never got a chance not only to work with him, I got to SI maybe 8-9 months after he was gone. But we never crossed paths either because I wasn't a soccer guy. The closest thing that would have happened was back in his early days, as you mentioned, when he was a college basketball writer. He, of course, did the cover story, the famous cover story on LeBron James when LeBron was still in high school. But other than that, you know, and I was in LA back then. We never crossed paths. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to, because it, from everything you have told me and everybody else has said and written about him, he just sounds like an amazing person. I would join you in just wishing the best to his family and condolences to everybody who knew him.
And Grant and I we were often at odds when it came to sports, because I have hated soccer. Like, I am not a soccer guy, to the point where I think it was 08-09 that Sports Illustrated assigned, they knew I hated soccer. It was kind of like a gimmick in the office. Like, you know, Grant was there, Mark Moravec, Grant's editor, was there. These were just avid soccer fans. And I'm an NBA guy. I like scoring. I don't really get the appeal of, I don't get it. I don't get the appeal of soccer.
Yeah.
I just didn't. And, you know, SI sent me up and down the East Coast in a minivan one year you know, for about a week, week and a half to send me to like four or five MLS games, a couple
of
international friendlies.
Who did you piss off for this to happen?
No, I actually loved it. I loved the idea. I'm like, all right, I'll go do it. Like, sure, why not? Like, plus at that point, I'm like 20-something trying to get magazine space. So I'm like, sure, yes. I'll do whatever you want.
Of course.
And, you know, like, I think they believed that I was going to leave that experience, like, buying into soccer, like, loving it. I did not. And I wrote a rather long story critical of soccer. I did the due diligence. I mean, I talked to elite soccer players. I, you know, was down on the field. I reported out the story. Like, I did the work. I still didn't like soccer. And Grant and I had some discussions about that in the aftermath of that story going to print. I had one editor of mine, and this was totally a jest. Like, he was just describing Grant's passion for soccer. He's like, you know, after you wrote that story, Grant probably wanted you fired at that point because like, you can't, like, any soccer coverage in Sports Illustrated should have been not positive necessarily, but something substantial. And it was, and me in a minivan with like half a dozen guys, sometimes from SI, sometimes from where I grew up, driving up and down the East Coast, was not a substantive use of soccer coverage, I think, in the eyes of Grant. But man, was he a titan when it came to soccer journalism. I think you can safely say the greatest soccer journalist of this generation, and you know, you can certainly make an argument that he's the greatest soccer journalist of all time. So he will be missed. All right, let's talk about a few things going on in the NBA right now. And I do want to talk about the Brooklyn Nets, Howard, because like Lazarus, the Nets have come back to life. They have won 8 of their last 9 games as we record this. They're sitting in the 4 seed in the Eastern Conference, just a half game behind Cleveland, 4.5 games behind Boston for the top spot. They are 15-7 since Jacques Vaughn took over as head coach. They have gone for a team that ranked in the bottom 5 in the NBA in efficiency rankings to ranking in the top 6 or 7 in offensive efficiency, defensive efficiency, net rating. They are clicking right now as a team. So I'll put the question to you, Howard. Have the Brooklyn Nets turned the corner? Are the Brooklyn Nets suddenly a conference contender?
No, they're not a conference contender.
People in New York are going to hate you. You know that, right? The Knicks, you kind of poo-poo their success. The Nets.
It's okay. Fine. Wait till we get to Westbrook. I'm just going to be Mr. Negative today. I'm sorry. Look, so let's a couple other quick numbers to just to throw out before we get into it. You noted them winning, what it was, eight of the last 10, whatever it's been. They're 11-3. Yeah, 11-3 in their last 14. And 16-7 since that 1-5 start. So over the last 14 in that 11-3, they're 10th in offensive rating in that time and 11th in defensive rating in that time, and 7th in net rating. So strong, not elite, but, you know, just outside the top 10 in offense and defense. For the season now, they've climbed all the way to 11th in offense and 13th in defense. Solid, solid. Not great, not spectacular, not dominant. Solid. Over that 14
they're gonna get a lot better
stretch
in offense too. They're gonna get a lot better offensively too. Like that number is gonna climb. We can debate defense, but they're gonna continue to get better offensively.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
<they're>,
wow.
Perspective on the 11-3. They beat Washington twice. Washington's terrible. And one of those games was without Beal. They beat Charlotte. They beat Orlando. Bad teams. They beat some good teams that are missing key players. They beat the Hawks without DeJounte Murray and some other guys. They beat Memphis without Ja Morant or Jaren Jackson Jr. or Desmond Bane. They beat Portland twice, and one of those games was without Dame. They, in the most significant matchup of this entire 14-game stretch, they got their butts kicked again by the Celtics, your Celtics. So, okay, the first step to being good and respectable in this league is beating bad teams and hopefully beating some of the other only solid to good teams. But if you want to be a contender, you got to beat Boston. And it's one game. It's one game. They might be better equipped to beat the Celtics and the Bucks and some others later in the season if your belief in their offense only improving is true. I'm curious to hear your theory on that. But we've got some bigger tests coming up. The Warriors will be here next week to play the Nets. That'll be followed by the Bucks. And then the Nets are going to go play a road game at Cleveland. So there you have, you know, the defending champs plus two of the top teams in the East coming up. And I think those will be better gauges. Where I'm not sold, Chris, is this. As constructed, they are never going to be great defensively. This is not there's no framework for a top 10 defense there. By the way, quick aside, the bar for the Nets shouldn't be, oh, they're a few games over 500 now and they've recovered. The bar for the Nets with three max players, three guys who are all NBA, one of whom Kevin Durant is playing at an MVP level. The bar ain't being pretty good. That was a really grammatically lovely sentence.
But by the way, I agree with you on the defense. And we had a similar conversation like 2 weeks ago. Remember when Jacques Vaughn took over, their defensive numbers climbed, and that was because of the teams that they played. I think their defense is a reflection of their opponents.
I'm also with you on that one. Yeah, I mean, listen, it's also that, you know, they got... So a bunch of things happened to turn this around, and I'm not going to diminish Jacques Vaughn's role in this at all. Jacques Vaughn, I think, has been great, and he's been the right guy at the right time. I love his demeanor. I didn't know Jacques Vaughn well before he took over, and I still don't know him well, but I'm at a lot of Nets home games because I live here. Jacques Vaughn's pregame with the media is like the most uplifting 15 minutes of my day sometimes. Like, he is so positive. He's always smiling. He's always cheerful. He gives thoughtful answers. He's always so upbeat. You leave the pregame presser with Jacques Vaughn, and like you're like ready, like, yeah, let's go. Like, he's and given how
Steve Nash was like the embodiment of embattled. Like, if you had the word embattled in the dictionary, that could be Steve Nash's picture right next to it.
And monotone, and just, you know, never felt like a head coach. He just never fit the role. So I think the transition to Jacques Vaughn has been a positive. It's not the most important of all of these, because I think all of these things are at work here. Seth Curry and Joe Harris were both hurt to start the season, and they got healthy. Ben Simmons was just a shadow of himself. People were saying, like, we may never see the old Ben Simmons again. Jacques Vaughn did not make Ben Simmons turn to Ben Simmons again. That was just Ben Simmons just had to get there. So that's not – some of this is about coaching, and I think the defensive focus has helped. Losing Kyrie to that suspension for 8 games, that's when they turned their defense around. Now, they've sustained it fairly well with him back, but they figured out a format. Part of that also being, by the way, Ben Simmons and Nick Claxton not playing as much together. Like, you can't start those guys together. You can't play them a ton together. It clogs up your offense. It might make them better defensively, but it clogs up your offense because you have two non-shooters out there. So I think they've figured out some things about the rotation. I think having a bunch of shooters healthy, I mentioned Curry and Joe Harris, and then you've got guys like Patty Mills available and Royce O'Neal. So there's a lot of good shooting to put around those three stars. But if Ben Simmons was playing at a below average level, which he was to start the season, then you're screwed. So having three max players that are now playing like max players, granted Simmons has been hurt again, helps. But let's be clear. The bar is title contention. Nothing less than that. If they just have a nice season, I'm not here to praise them for having three max players, three guys who have all been all NBA in the last few years, who are going to be just good enough to be a 4 or 5 seed. That's not the bar here. And that's just not the standard. So they're good. They're better than they were. They're still not at the level I think that they're supposed to be given their star power. And I don't know that they're going to get there. Ben Simmons is getting hurt because the back leads to the knee, which leads to whatever else.
Yeah.
Kevin Durant has not been out yet. They rested him for a game. That, by the way, incredible win in Indiana when they rested 8 guys. The Nets rested 8 guys and beat Indiana. Shame on the Pacers in Indiana.
Thomas time.
Oh my gosh. Like, that was a preseason game. That was like just a preseason game. So Kevin Durant has not missed time yet. And it is, I hate to say this, I'm not wishing this on him. Kevin Durant, it is almost inevitable he's going to miss 10, 12, 15, 16 games at some point, because that's the history of a post-Achilles player, and that's been his history since his Achilles in 2019. So at some point, he may go down for an extended period with a hamstring, a quad, an ankle, a calf. And what are they going to be without him? And by the way, they're playing him heavy minutes. Every single night, Jacques Vaughn says, we got to lower his minutes. We got to ratchet back his minutes. They can't, because Ben Simmons, as great as he is, can't carry you. Kyrie Irving, as great as he is not going to carry you most nights. It's all about Kevin Durant. As long as he's great, they're good. But I just think there's a lot of volatility within that still. And, you know, we never know when the next Kyrie Irving thing, whatever that thing is going to be, there's going to be another Kyrie Irving thing because there always is.
I can't get I need a deep dive on why Nets coaches from Steve Nash to now Jock Vaughn won't give Cam Thomas more playing time. Like, he got 29 minutes in that Pacers game, scored 33 points.
All right, I have a question for you. I can answer your question with a question.
Okay.
Have you ever seen Cam Thomas pass the ball?
No, I haven't. Well, I'll say this. From when I talk to people in Brooklyn.
Cam Thomas is all about Cam Thomas, baby.
Okay, but he's gotten a little bit better with the ball movement. Didn't need to be a ball mover in that game against Indiana because it was, you know, Cam time. All that.
Because it was like a preseason game.
Right, but like, you know, but you saw in the playoffs last year when Durant's out there for 40-plus minutes and he's dragging at the end of those games. Like, could Cam Thomas not have played 5 minutes in the second quarter to give Kevin Durant a rest? I feel the same way. Like, he's starting to get some minutes in December. Like, I look at some of these games, like against Charlotte, he played 5 minutes. Against Boston, 9 minutes. Portland, 6 minutes. Philadelphia, 3 minutes. Like, just like you need to get Kevin Durant off the floor for like 3 to 5 extra minutes per game. You got to get him off there because I agree with you that the minutes is a problem, and it's been a problem the last two seasons in Brooklyn. Last three, really, because when he came back from that Achilles injury, you saw him in the playoffs that first year, and he was playing 40 plus minutes in the postseason. You got to get him off the floor. Now, one thing I that makes me optimistic about the Nets is that the new thing in this last 8-9 games, in addition to playing like a million games at home, they had one of the longest homestands I've ever had. It's all about basketball. We're not talking about off-court issues. We're not talking about Kevin Durant's trade request. We're not talking about Kyrie and his status with the team and is he anti-Semitic or isn't he? We're not talking about Ben Simmons as much as we used to, at least, right? Like, you know, we're not wondering, you know, will Ben Simmons ever be able to play? Like, he's dealing with injuries, and I'm with you there, too. I think that's a legitimate concern because the back is connected to the knee, which is connected to the calf, and all these things can kind of, you know, come together to form a big problem for Brooklyn. But it's all about basketball right now with the Nets. And
yeah,
if they can keep it focused on basketball, they've got a chance here. They're going to fall defensively. They've got that tough schedule, as you pointed out, coming up. And I'm curious to see what they do against Golden State, against Milwaukee, against the top-tier teams in both conferences. But if they can keep it locked in on basketball and Kevin Durant can stay on the floor, they're a top-5 team in the Eastern Conference and not one I'd be all that excited about playing in the first or second round.
Can I just give you a quick Cam Thomas note?
We're still in Cam Thomas. The hell?
I just had to look. Cam Thomas's usage rate, this is comical, is 22.6. You know who's got usage rates higher than him? Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. That's it. End of list on the Nets. He has the third highest usage rate at 22.6. His assist rate.
Yeah, I know. That's where you're going. I know where you're going with this. Go ahead.
His assist rate, on the other hand, is 13.3. That's eighth on the Nets. So remember, he was he was throwing shade at Steve Nash in summer league because he got opportunities to score in summer league, and then he was like making these offhand remarks that were clearly shots at Steve Nash. And now, within the last couple weeks, I think he's actually said again, maybe after the Pacer game, where he was like, "Yeah, you know, I just need opportunities. You know, if somebody, people just got to put me out there." Like, Cam Thomas wants to get out there and shoot a lot of shots. That's the lesson of Cam Thomas. I'm sorry. That's a bad digression just to point out some unflattering stats. You were saying about the Nets and the upside. You know, listen, I don't want to face Kevin Durant in the playoffs if I'm the Celtics, the Bucks, anybody else. I'm not sold on the rest of the Nets, but like, Kevin Durant at any given time is a potential atomic bomb going off. On the other hand, the Celtics completely throttled him and Kyrie last spring, and I don't see any reason why
did,
they wouldn't
they
be able
did,
to
again. Though, but Howard, like those games like were decided by a combined like 8 points or something like that. Like, you know, they swept the Nets, and that is what
but
it
Durant
is.
Durant never could take over. It could
not. He was 40%, I think, from the field in that series. Yeah. That was like, or somewhere around there. It was bad.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's anything fundamentally different about this version of the Nets that's going to make them capable of beating a fully functioning Celtics or Bucks team if those teams are healthy. So I have not wavered from my position that I still think, like, I do not see them as a title contender this season. And since they are not, and since Kyrie Irving is probably leaving in free agency next summer, I still say blow this thing up. So
I still, I mean, the way, like, Kyrie has is still volatile, to say the least. But I'm not as convinced as I used to be that Kyrie was gone. Because, like, the Nets, if they let him walk, it's not like they have any kind of cap flexibility. Like, they've got Simmons under contract.
No, they can't.
They've got
Durant
under
him.
Contract. So,
but, man, think about the signals that they have sent about how freaking pissed off they've been with him. The stuff that Sean Marks had to say after the season last spring, the things that they said even on media day whenever they brought everybody back, the things that Josiah had to say on Twitter after Kyrie's ridiculous social media saga. The vaccination issues, they don't need to, like that's in the past now. We don't have to worry about the vaccine thing again. And we don't have to worry about presumably him posting any more anti-Semitic films or anything else like that. But, like, it's always something. And I think it's clear that they're tired of the somethings and the unknown. Yeah. I know they can't replace him because the way the cap works, if you're over, you're screwed. You cannot get the equivalent of Kyrie Irving on the market unless you do a sign and trade. But I just cannot see them opting for another year of him.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think you're more likely than not. About 3 weeks ago, though, I would have said 100% chance he's not back. Now I'm like 75% chance he's not back.
A lot
back.
Of games left to be played, Chris. Yeah. A lot of games.
All right. Speaking of games, Russell Westbrook been playing some good games of late. I want to get into this for a minute. I wrote on SI.com on Tuesday about Westbrook's kind of evaluating where Westbrook is as a sixth man. I talked to a lot of people around the league about Westbrook, coaches, general managers, talked to Stan Van Gundy for a while, talked to Dwayne Wade, who is one of the few superstars who briefly, successfully transitioned into a sixth man role in his final year in Miami. Westbrook has played 22 games off the bench this season with the Lakers. He's averaging about 15 points. He's handing out about 8 assists. His plus-minus is still in the red. He's about minus 2.5, but that's an improvement over the minus 5.3 he was in his three games as a starter. And more importantly, like, he's sort of passing the eyeball test, Howard. Like, you're seeing a guy that, when he gets on the floor, is not, you know, kind of the liability he used to be. He's productive. I mean, I was watching the Pistons game on Sunday. He comes in 6 minutes into the first quarter. He has 6 points. He has 4 assists. He's, you know, moving well. It seems to be working for Russell Westbrook in this role. Give me your evaluation of kind of Westbrook as a sixth man. And yeah, start there. Like, what are you seeing out of Westbrook as a sixth man?
So, as you noted, it's been like, how many games now? 22 games. 15 points, 5.5 rebounds, 8 assists in a bench role. That's kind of what you want from him. The shooting is what it is. Shooting 32% from three as a reserve and worse overall.
Which,
for the
season.
Which,
by the way, when compared to his previous seasons, like, 32% is sniper territory for
Westbrook. You know, just getting him up over 30% is a victory
He's
in itself.
He's only done it once since his MVP season.
Yeah. You know, true shooting percentage is just over 500. It's fine. It's not, you know, it's not spectacular, but, you know, whatever. His overall field goal percentage, 42%. It's fine. I think the positive here is that he's accepted the role, embraced the role, functioned well in the role. And here I go being negative again. Westbrook is unchanged, though. I mean, he has adapted and he has subsumed his ego for the sake of better of team goals, right? All credit to him for doing that. It's good.
It's probably
to see
some self-preservation in that too.
Sure, and it's been good for the Lakers. Yeah, of course, definitely some self-preservation because he knows he's a free agent next summer, and he's got to show that he's going to be adaptable if he's going to continue in this league. But the rest of Westbrook remains the same, right? He's still not a good 3-point shooter, but he's still going to take those threes. He's still not a guy who's going to do much off the ball. So the ball's got to be in his hands when he's on the floor, which means he's still not great as a co-star to LeBron. And he's still not going to defend. So all the flaws are still there. And if you're the Lakers, you're just now managing those flaws. And if you are a rival team that's considering trading for him or considering signing him next summer, those flaws haven't gone away, and he's still getting older, and so he's, of course, you know, not as great at finishing at the rim and yada, yada, yada. So I still think the future for him is a little cloudy, and I still think his future with the Lakers is limited. Like, at most, he's gone after this season. They'll happily accept the cap room and use it on other players to build out a more balanced roster, which they had before they traded all of that balance for him. I still think there's a ceiling, though, on this team as constructed. And again, we can get all excited about their recovery, Chris, but they, you know, they've beaten up mostly on some bad teams. They've had a couple of good wins along the way against some good teams too. We covered some of this last week, but I don't, like, they're still what, like 11th, 12th in the West. Like I don't see a scenario. They're 12th and four games under 500. I don't see this a scenario where they are jumping up into contention. And I still think that, and maybe Westbrook's better play helps this, I still think your best bet is trading Westbrook and one or both of those future picks to get the immediate help. We've covered that to death. Everybody has. I don't think that reality has changed. Westbrook being solid in that six-man role is a positive for them, but the flaws and the limitations are still there.
Yeah. You know, I think in this role, he has a lot, he can have a lot more success being the player he thinks he still is, right? Like, when he's not worried right from the jump about getting Anthony Davis involved, getting LeBron James involved, if he just has to go out there and, you know, beat up on a lot of second unit guys, he can still be successful. I had one GM, you know, compare this role to what Westbrook did during his MVP season. You know, the guy was half kidding, but he's like, he was basically playing with second teamers in Oklahoma City. Like, at that time, that was post Durant. And, you know, there wasn't a depth of talent there in Oklahoma after Durant walked. So he was able to just kind of do his thing out there. And being with the second unit, he has more freedom to do his thing. You're right. He's never going to be a lethal 3-point shooter. He's always going to think he is, so he's going to take bad shots during games. And I should point out, like, in the fourth quarter of that Pistons game, he wasn't on the floor. Like, you know, Darvin Ham deemed it better to keep him off on the bench and have Austin Reeves in there and other guys in there as opposed to Russell Westbrook. So it's not like he's... I don't see this, like, rosy 4 or 5 year future, but I do see a future now for Russell Westbrook because this is the only way it was going to work. And what I'd like to see from Westbrook is more than just an acceptance of this role. I want to see, like, a full-throated embrace of this role. I was talking to Dwayne Wade about this last week, and one thing Wade said to me was like, man, I knew I was done at the end. Like, you know, his body was done. Like, he wasn't going to keep playing basketball in his final year in the NBA. But he's like, that role? It's like, I loved it. He's like, if my body was better and healthier, you know, he would have been happy playing 2, 3, 4 more years as a sixth man. I'd like to see that from Westbrook. Like, now, it feels like now he's kind of begrudgingly going on to it. Like, he does all these interviews. People ask him all the time about the sixth man role, and he kind of brushes it all off. He's like, I'll just play what I'm told, all that stuff. I'd like to see Westbrook be like, this is great. I love this. I have a chance to be sixth man of the year. I have a chance to, you know, burnish my resume, add to my legacy by being a contributor off the bench for a winning team. Because that's what I think he can be. Like, when I talked to executives about Westbrook, you know, 3 weeks ago, they would have said, hell no, we wouldn't touch him in the offseason. Now, if he continues to play like this and operate like this, he's got a chance for a winning team to sign him, probably not for more than the mid-level exception, but he's got a chance for a winning team to sign him and play him in a reasonable role. That's not something I think either one of us would have expected at the start of the season. I mean, it wasn't hyperbole to say this might have been Westbrook's last year. Like, it sounded like it, but it really wasn't. Like, who was going to sign him if he was hell-bent on being a starter and playing 30-plus minutes a night? This version of Westbrook, short-term, can help the Lakers to the point where I don't think the Lakers are going to attach much, if anything, to Westbrook in a trade. Like, you know, might they have attached unprotected first a month ago? Probably. But now, unless they're getting back a real difference maker, they're not attaching an unprotected first-round pick to Russell Westbrook. That's not my read of the situation anyway. So short-term, he can help. And long-term, he can be a guy that can be a productive player. That's sort of what I've taken away from this, Howard, that he's gone from a guy that in early November was done. You're talking about a guy done. Like, you know, this was his last year in the NBA. He'd go from making $45 million per year in the NBA to zero next year. Now, I can certainly see him signing like a PJ Tucker-esque three-year, $30-plus million contract with a contending team next year if he's willing to embrace this role.
I'm not all the way there yet, in part because teams...
You're not alone, by the way. You're not alone. Like, your friend Stan Van Gundy, I talked to him for a while. He was also... He praised what Westbrook has done, but when I asked him about Westbrook's long-term future, he's like, let's just wait and see, all right? Let's just see how this season plays out.
Part of it is you just have to do the exercise if you look around the league and you say, okay, how are teams situated at the position, right? He's, you know, even at this stage of his career... Westbrook is a primary ball handler. That is who he is. So whether he's a starter or whether he's a reserve, if he is on your team and on the floor, you have to expect the ball to be in his hands, which means you need a lot of shooters around him and defenders around him to function. So fit is one challenge. The other thing is just that the position's really deep, right? Like, let's take the Grizzlies, for example, right?
I was going to use that example because Westbrook – in a way, kind of mirrors the style of play of Ja Morant.
Right. But Ja Morant, young superstar, backed up by Tyus Jones, phenomenal backup. Go to teams around the league. Who would you rather have, Tyus Jones or Russell Westbrook? They're all going to say Tyus Jones.
Tyus Jones, yeah.
And so that's the exercise. Where do you find the fit? And we don't have to go through that now. We'll probably be having this discussion, you know, next spring at some point about where is Westbrook going to be next. But like finding the right fit and finding a team that actually needs that guy, a ball dominant backup point guard, it's still a little bit of a challenge. I'm not saying he's going to be gone. I'm not saying that there's not a fit for him somewhere next season. But you know, the other question is this: like, okay, he's accepted this for now, but you point out in your column and you just noted it a second ago too, like Westbrook is not exactly speaking enthusiastically about this. He's accepted it. But has he truly like embraced it as a long-term thing, or is this just something like, I got to do this to get through the season? And is he going to see himself in free agency next summer as a guy who, when he's talking to teams, says, and by the way, whether you're paying me $10 million, $20 million, $5 million, I expect to come in and start, play big minutes, and dominate the ball like I have my whole career. That's not going to go over well with teams. And I don't know if he has evolved enough in his own head about his role to accept that. And if he hasn't, like that, you know, that could still create a major barrier for him in terms of finding another home.
Yeah. I think we'll be able to paint a much better picture in March and April about Westbrook's future. And if he plays this way, maybe. If he regresses, declines, definitely not. This could go a lot of different ways for Russell Westbrook. Last thing I want to talk about.
One last thought on him.
Okay. Yeah.
Quick thing. One last thought on him before we leave this. As long as he's with the Lakers, by the way, and you pointed this out, he's like averaging like 6.5 minutes per fourth quarter, right? He is not playing a massive part of the fourth quarter. And you mentioned a game recently where he wasn't even out there. You have $47 million. It's 47, right? Tied up in him. Yeah. So part of the reason for trading him still is that you'd rather have players for that amount of money. That's almost, you know, like it's like more than a third of the salary cap. You want that to be in players who could be productive for you and reliable in fourth quarters. If you can't play him in fourth quarters because he doesn't fit with LeBron and because he doesn't shoot well and because he's going to take some ill-advised shots at bad moments, that's another argument for trading him for multiple players who actually can be out there. All right, that's my last Westbrook thought.
And he's had a couple of games, even during this recent run of success for the Lakers, where he's in the fourth quarter and he's taking some very ill-advised shots. Shots that should be going to LeBron, should be going to AD. Like that's you got to clean that up if you're going to have any chance to play for a winner. I want to talk briefly about the situation in Washington right now. Wizards, as of Tuesday afternoon when we're recording this, lost 7 straight. Bradley Beal's been in a lot of the lineup with injuries. When he's in the lineup, he's pretty good. He's played 18 games this year, averaging about 22 points, shooting like 50-something percent from the floor, 35% from three. So he's still a productive player. But kind of predictably, Howard, the Wizards aren't going anywhere in this situation. And I'm a fan of the Wizards front office. Tommy Shepard's done some nice things with the guys around Bradley Beal. Some of the draft picks they've made have been very good. But I never really understood why the Wizards didn't move him in the offseason. And I never really got why there wasn't more effort to explore sign and trade scenarios in the offseason. Last season with the trade, offseason with sign and trade stuff. They're not good enough. And, you know, Bradley Beal, who has played, I think, some pretty good minutes in recent years. If I'm looking at some of his numbers, yeah, you go back to 18-19, he played 82 games, led the NBA in minutes, 36 minutes during the shortened COVID season. Next year's at 36 minutes. Last year only plays 40 games with 36 minutes. At 35 minutes this year. Like, I think we're entering the territory where Bradley Beal is no longer the 28 to 30 point per game scorer. He's still a 20 plus point per game guy, but he's not a carry your team to the next level type of guy. Again, I didn't understand the decision not to trade him before, but I feel like now, even in the first year of this contract, you've got to start looking at ways to get off Bradley Beal and get something substantive back in return. Now, the Wizards, again, this was puzzling. They gave Bradley Beal a no-trade clause. I don't know why they did that. I don't know why, after giving him a five-year max contract, giving him all the money they could, they tacked on a no-trade clause. Like, I get why Bradley Beal would want it, because it gives him control, but why the Wizards would do that, it eludes me. This is not a team going anywhere, Howard. Like, at best, to me, they're kind of a play-in type of team. Maybe they get hot, get into the postseason as a result of that, but they're going to get creamed by somebody in the first round. Is it too early, as we get towards this, you know, mid-December start of trade season, to start looking at Bradley Beal as someone Washington should look to move off of?
Yes. And if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have said yes. And if you've asked me 2 years ago, I would have said yes. And if you'd asked me 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said yes. I would have said yes before this past extension and before the extension before that. They keep doing this. The Wizards have, like, talk about a stubborn franchise. And this predates Tommy as GM. And obviously he worked under Ernie Grunfeld. And I like both of these guys very much. Great people. And I think they've both done some wonderful things with the Wizards. But as a franchise, and this goes, I think, all the way up to ownership, to be honest, they've been very stubborn about pivoting. They don't want to pivot. The John Wall, Bradley Beal era was fun. It was moderately successful for a time. And yet at their peak, those two together never won more than 49 games. Elite in this league is like 60 plus. Now you're a title contender. 50 plus means you're one of the best teams in the NBA, and you need to get to like 55 if you want to be really serious. But like, you got to at least get to 50. They never even got to 50. They've got one playoff series victory in like the last 6-7 years. They've just never been that good. They are the epitome of the treadmill of mediocrity. And they've decided to stay on that treadmill. That's a choice. They traded Wall when they finally had an opportunity to unload him for another bad contract, Russell Westbrook. And then they made a great trade with Westbrook, right? Like, we all agree. Everybody in the league has agreed from the moment it happened. The Wizards made a great trade in dumping Westbrook for Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Kyle Kuzma and Montrezl Harrell. And the Lakers made a terrible trade in doing that deal. So they've done some good things, but where has it gotten them? And then everything has been kind of like deals that they kind of had to make. There's a fork in the road, right? They kind of need to get off of Wall, so they got Westbrook. They had to get off of Westbrook. They got a decent package. They needed to get off of Spencer Dinwiddie and Davis Bertans, because they overpaid them both, and they parlayed them into Porzingis, who's actually been pretty good for them. The usual health issues here and there, but Porzingis has been very good. But a Bradley Beal, Kristaps Porzingis duo is not getting you anywhere, really. Like, at best, they're a first-round and out team. So where are they? So when you ask, like, should they trade Beal? Of course they should trade Beal, except he's now got this no-trade clause that they shouldn't have given him, and which complicates any deal. Now, their point is, I've talked to the Wizards about this, their point has been all along, listen, if we get to the point where we're going to trade Beal, it's going to be in concert with him anyway. We're not going to trade him somewhere where he doesn't want to go. He's been too great to this franchise and the city.
Because they can't. I mean, for starters, they can't.
They're saying the no trade clause is immaterial because we would have given him the option
to steer
it anyway. It's
not immaterial. Which is ludicrous.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Bradley Beal is I know what you're saying. Like, Bradley Beal is a good guy and a really good player, but he's not LeBron James. He's not like Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce. Like, he's not a guy you work with to make sure he's happy with a deal. If you're the Washington Wizards, you got to be happy with the deal. I mean, Howard, look at this roster. Like, you're not winning anything with this roster. Their ceiling to me. Ceiling is play-in. Like, that to me is the team that they are. You look at the depth chart with this group. The future of this team is Denny Avdija. The future of this team is Rui Hachimura. The future of this team is Johnny Davis, who was their first-round pick this past year. Like, those guys are the future of this team. Like what are they going to do next summer? Like, if they play this out? Like, Kyle Kuzma's going to opt out of his contract. You got to pay Kyle Kuzma to come back to be part of whatever? Like, there's an opportunity.
Aren't there rumblings already that he wants out?
Well, I mean, I think he wants to get paid. I understand that somewhere. He's got $13 million coming next year in a player option. He's going to opt out of that. And he's Kyle's probably, he's worth more than that. Now's his time to cash in the NBA. But you're in a position right now, if you're Washington, where because, as you wrote so well on SI.com, there's so much parity in the NBA. Like, if you're putting guys on the block, you're going to have competition for teams that want to get him. So you put Kyle Kuzma out there, even in what's effectively the last year of his contract. I mean, teams willing to give up first-round draft capital for Kyle Kuzma, I would think. You put Bradley Beal on the block. You're going to get a lot of teams interested with, like, multiple first-round picks and young players. Like, whether it's, I look at the teams out in California, Golden State, would they get interested in Bradley Beal? The Lakers, they're interested in everybody, So, that might be the player that they attach those two unprotected first-round picks to. If you're Washington and that comes to fruition, you got to jump at that. The Wizards were a nice story to start the season. They were playing well. They were above 500. They looked good. But they have come crashing back down to earth. Some of that has to do with Beal being hurt in and out of the lineup. I get that. But this is just a very average team. And I don't see the pathway through organic growth or off-season acquisitions to get this Bradley Beal-led team into a better place. And if you believe that, what are you doing? Like, you're not drawing fans anyway. They're 26th in the NBA in attendance, a ghost town there at a lot of these games. What are you doing? What is the point of keeping this group together? That's my big thing. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. No, and it's going to continue to hurt them. So, the treadmill of mediocrity, what is that? The treadmill of mediocrity is never being bad enough to get high lottery
picks. And
this is
the year to tank. This is the year to blow it. This is it.
For sure.
Never
being good enough to be relevant. So they are trapped in the middle. They've put themselves there. Here's where they've picked over the last several years. 10th this past draft. Before that, 15th, 9th, 9th, 15th. Unless you are the one in a million shot that gets Giannis at 15 or Kawhi Leonard at 15 or Paul George at like 11, Rudy Gobert at 27, like Jimmy Butler at 30. Those come along every now and then.
And they've been okay. Like, I think Rui can play. I think he's been
injured
a little bit.
Let's do a quick review. 2021, they took Corey Kispert at 15 over Alperen Şengün, Trey Murphy, Bones Highland, and Herb Jones.
In fairness, everybody passed on Alperen Şengün. I think that pick was traded like 7 times before he was picked.
I'm just saying, there's like 4 guys I just named who would be better. 2020, Avdija over Tyrese Halliburton. Now, a bunch of teams missed on Halliburton.
Everybody missed on Halliburton. Yeah.
But we can smack every single one of them, most of them, for passing on him. Hachimura, they took over Cam Johnson, over Tyler Hero, over Matisse Thybul, over Jordan Poole. 2018, Troy Brown, 15th, over Dante DiVincenzo, over Anthony Simons, over Kevin Huerter, over Jalen Brunson. I'm not saying these guys are like MVPs or all NBA superstars, but like, you have to, when you're picking outside of the top 3, top 5, whatever, and the further down you go, the more volatility there is, It's not that we grade you on whether you aced every draft. Nobody does that. But if you're, you know, over a course of 4, 5, 6, 7 years, you've got to nail one now and then. You got to be the team that got Halliburton. You got to be the team that picked Anfernee Simons or Tyler Hero or Herb Jones. The Wizards are not that team. They have picked perfectly solid, fine players who are not raising their floor. That's the problem. And they are stuck on this cycle. And as long as they keep Bradley Beal, they'll still be in this cycle. And yes, the no trade clause makes it more difficult to get full value because you can't play all 29 teams off of each other or 10 or 15 of them or whatever it's
like
going to
be. Five. You can operate with five, basically.
Maybe. Yeah. And it's Beal's list. And so, you know, good luck leveraging all that. So no, like I think they've really kind of boxed themselves in.
Yeah. I just don't. Every time I watch a Wizards game, and I saw them when they came up to Boston, I watched a couple of their games on TV. It's like, all right, what's the plan here? Like, you know, Porzingis, I think he's got another year left in his contract. Like, he's like, start paying these guys like to stay and be this middling team. I don't understand it at all.
But by the way, I know teams are scared. Like Ted Leonsis is afraid of a future of which they've traded Bradley Beal, who's been the face of their franchise for so long and has been a great guy for them and has been great in the community and all that. I get it. But like, look at where Utah is now. They traded the two faces of their franchise and they are in perfectly good shape right now with good players and a ton of picks coming, and they're respectable and they're fine. Look at where the Thunder are now, just 3 years after trading Paul George and Russell Westbrook. Like, the Thunder are looking like they don't have a winning record, but the Thunder are really competitive. They're interesting. They're fun. They're on the right path. They've got a ton of picks coming. Look at where New Orleans is 3 years after trading Anthony Davis at gunpoint. Look at even where Memphis is after trading Mike Conley and Marc Gasol, who they held on to for far too long, but they finally did it and they set themselves up nicely. Like, you just have to sometimes rip the damn Band-Aid off and do it smartly, and within 2 to 3 seasons, you can be back in business, because Memphis is living proof of that. The Thunder are living proof of that. The Pelicans are living proof of that.
Make the right deals and sell high on your guys, right? Yes. I don't know if Beal's at his high point right now. Probably last year would have been his high point, because you'd have his bird rights. You've traded him to the right team. They would have given up a lot. But Kuzma, like, you can sell him high right now. I don't know if there's a market for Porzingis at this point, but I'd try to sell him too. I'd try to get young players and draft picks. I'd bottom out. I'd get a high pick.
For sure.
And I'd start to build around these guys. Like, I keep going back to this, but like, who would you alienate if that happens? Nobody goes to your games. Nobody watches your games. So who are you pissing off in this point? Like, it's not like you're going to see this catastrophic dip in attendance and TV ratings. They were, I think, last season 24th in local TV ratings. Like, you're not bothering people.
I know, like,
in fact, you might be able to reinvigorate them. Like, this is what we're doing. Like, this is, yeah.
Who are you going to piss off? I know, like, two Wizards fans.
Respect to the
Maybe three if you count Wolf Blitzard. I don't actually know Wolf.
Yeah, don't tweet at us either, Wizards fan. I know there are passionate Wizards fans out there, but there are not enough of you. That's the problem. There needs to be more of you to make anything happen. All right, Howard will be back on Friday. We will be back next week. Good to talk to you, my friend.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
Home Club for details.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.